All right. Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. Some of our colleagues are on their way, but we've got a very busy agenda, as you can tell, so we're going to get started by opening an informational hearing on the University Venture Development Fund. Representative Olson, and I think I saw Representative Rayfield moving around, so if you guys would like to join us, and we'll get started.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Andy Olson. I'm the state representative out of the Albany area, and I appreciate this opportunity to come before you. I'm going to be quick here because I really want to kind of allow Brian Wall over here on the far end of me from OSU and Dr. Evan Thomas from Portland State to share and kind of open this up a little bit more. But this whole issue is regarding the University Venture Development Fund, UVDF, as we'll term it. Representative Dan Rayfield from Corvallis also has been deeply involved with this as well, and we're moving forward a short session next year with a bill concerning this. A couple points I just want to make quickly that these gentlemen are going to be sharing with you. How UVDF has helped convert research conducted at the 8 public universities here in Oregon into new businesses, creating growth through education at the same time. So that connection, that bridge. They will describe how UVDF is an important tool for moving innovations from lab into economy. They will walk you through how the tax credits generate new state income as a result of employment growth. Additionally, they will show how the figures continue to grow. And then finally, Brian and Evan will discuss how the UVDF tax credit is unique among all state credits because in addition to generating new income taxes, universities repay the state treasury with revenues generated by successful businesses. So with that, Mr. Chair and committee members, I'll stop and let them.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. As you may remember, this committee is not completely unfamiliar with this topic, having heard it before, and at least a couple of us following it through the rest of the process, though I speak for myself, disappointed that it didn't make it through. So feel free to be quick with your background information.
Sure.
Thanks.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and committee. We'll cruise through this. As you mentioned, many of you have heard this. The summary is, you know, this.
If you could begin by introducing yourself, please.
Yes. Brian Wall, Assistant Vice President for Research, Commercialization, and Industry Partnering at Oregon State University.
Thank you.
This tax credit leverages the research through the universities, federal-funded research, by providing a filling need in this gap where most investors and other funding entities don't have any availability to provide any funds. Last session we looked at attempting to increase the tax credit amount, thinking, you know, we were having success in this. We wanted to raise the amount. We decided this round, let's just go back to what was allocated in 2007. The whole concept in 2007 was to allocate $8.4 million in tax credit authority to all the universities, and the idea was this is the only tax credit that has the charge to repay the tax credits, which would produce an evergreen type fund, allowing us to continue to raise and stay basically at that $8.4 million cap and continue to raise money and repay it and then keep this cycle going. For every $100, of course, the state tax credit provides, $166.66 is put into the program. And then what we thought we'd do is just basically kind of walk through how the money flows, because the repayment is somewhat complex. Wanted to make sure everyone understood how that worked, and then certainly allow Evan some time just to talk about his company and what's happening with Oregon jobs and manufacturing. So we'll cruise through that. So how this works is, individuals donate money into any university's venture development fund. We've raised $7.7 million collectively since 2007, which produced a $4.7 million tax credit loss. Out of that, collectively, 27 companies were launched. They had benefited from the research at the universities and made a decision to form a company. And approximately 270 positions were created by those companies during this time period. And one thing I should point out is, you know, university-based intellectual property licensing startups generally has an 8 to 12-year type cycle when an invention comes in, when they receive some of this type of funding to get a startup going to actually produce significant returns. It takes
are these jobs according to the contract? They're not ongoing. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wizard.
Thank you. I apologize. No problem. Got starting her.
It's exciting.
So these jobs, are they based upon the length of the contract, or are they for the grant, or how does that work? They're not permanent. Are we adding 270 jobs in the universities? Is that my question?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Winston. The jobs are created within the companies. So the company, so the universities would allocate funding based on some research results, target that towards a specific market, protect the intellectual property, license it to a startup company, and the company would then raise additional funding if needed and start selling products and services and hiring. So those jobs aren't under contract. Those are jobs that should remain and continue to grow. So this slide just shows the jobs that were created, and in just kind of another pool that comes back to the state treasury is really the high wage job, the jobs taxes on those wages come back to the state treasury. Now, the licensing revenues, you know, these are revenues that the companies are paying to the universities based on the intellectual property that was created by these tax credits. And out of that is what gets repaid back to regenerate tax credits to the state treasury. So the 4.7 that was in tax credit authority is now 4.2. It's reduced because we've collectively as universities have paid back $582,000 so far. And this is kind of just the tipping point again, just to mention, because we're still really early in the stage of seeing company success come out of this. So this slide basically just shows the total amount of what we're seeking. We would raise $14 million. We're intending to launch many more companies that produce many more jobs that continue to pay back. We're looking for an extension that would end up being an $8.4 million in tax credit authority as suggested in 2007. Right now, the income tax revenues resulting from this we're estimating to be about $4.3 million. We believe the trajectory would bring in about $8.3 million because those companies will continue to hire and grow. If we extend this program, we feel strongly we're going to be able to raise additional funding, actually deploy more that's in our coffers right now, create more companies, even more than the 27 we did last round, and that should produce a significant return in the tax revenues coming back.
I'm not looking for a long answer to this question, but how optimistic or conservative would you characterize that forecast as?
I think that's a fairly conservative forecast, purely because just looking at the numbers of what we've done collectively since 2007, what I ended up doing is just running kind of some spreadsheets to figure out what that looks like. If we created another 27 companies, what would that look like? My estimate is we'll create more than that, purely because it took us several years to raise the funding to then be able to deploy it. And so the 27 companies and the 270 jobs are literally just at that starting point, and it should be accelerating pretty rapidly at this point forward.
Thank you.
Just a note, before we had the availability of a gap fund like this, the universities collectively produced about 40 companies in about a seven-year period. Once this launched, we significantly increased the number of startups coming out. Now, not all of these received university venture development funding, but a key point of the venture funding is to actually enable entrepreneurship and education in the universities and outside the universities. So, for example, OSU's Accelerator receives some of the UVDF money to support those projects moving through, and you'll see a significant increase on that. So what this particular bill will do retain the limitation at $8.4 million, same as the 2007 legislation, sunset it in 2022, and then enable the ability for the universities to transfer tax credits as needed as allocations reach their maximum. For now, I'd like to turn it over to Evan Thomas, who's CEO of SweetSense, a beneficiary of this funding.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Thomas.
Thank you, Chair. Evan Thomas, I'm a professor of mechanical engineering at Portland State University, and I'm also the CEO of SweetSense, Inc., which is a company that's received support from the UVDF Fund. Our research at Portland State focuses on poverty reduction globally. We use sensor technologies, cell phone-enabled sensor technologies, to help monitor assets that are installed in countries like Rwanda or Indonesia or Bangladesh. We work in 15 countries around the world to help improve service delivery, to help use data derived from these sensors to incentivize and deliver clean water, clean air, energy interventions. We started this as a research project. We received grant funding from Mercy Corps and the Lemelson Foundation to come up with this idea. And after the first few years, we had a product that we were ready to start commercializing. We're moving from graduate students and undergrads building these things in our lab at PSU to the point where there was enough demand that we needed to move it outside of the university. 4 years ago, we started SweetSense, Inc. and received some funding from UVDF. This came at a critical point for us when we were not yet attractive for angel investors or other external investors to help create SweetSense, but we were no longer receiving grant funds to create the technology. So we were in this valley of death in between the concept and actually being a commercial company. UVDF came in at that point and gave us a grant to support commercializing the technology. Today, we have $3 million in contracts for this year. We employ 8 people in Oregon. 6 of those jobs are over $100,000 a year jobs. 5 of them are Portland State graduates, people that have come out of the university system. We manufacture our technology in Oregon, entirely in Oregon, and we have customers in 15 countries around the world, including Unilever, the United Kingdom government, USAID, the World Bank, the Gates Foundation, and numerous others. And we've also been able to now take on external investors and run the company entirely separately from the university. But we maintain a relationship with Portland State. We have other graduate students and research grants that are capitalizing on the momentum within the company. So we're actually creating additional revenue into the university system thanks to the company being able to move the technology forward. And this is a common challenge with small startups, where you have that idea, you can get a little bit of money together, you can get a little bit of grant funds together to demonstrate a concept, but there's a long road in between the concept and being able to operate off of revenues. And there's a long road in between getting that first seed money and being attractive to traditional investors. And that's where UVDF has played an important role for our company.
Very good. Good questions. Let's see. Thank you very much for being here. We appreciate the update. We expect, I think I can speak for the other committee, we look forward to the conversation in the February session as well. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll close the informational hearing on the University Venture Development Fund and open informational hearing on outcomes-based funding. Ben Cannon is going to give us an update. We're moving into sort of the update portion of the agenda today, both on outcomes-based funding, and then we'll hear about the open education resources. We're moving very quickly today. Mr. Cannon, thank you for being here.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, here to update you on funding distribution models, including one that we have adopted for the public universities that is partially outcomes-based, and that's where I will focus my presentation. I have a number of slides here. I'll move fairly quickly through some of them. There will be more detail presented in them than I'll describe, and I'm certainly happy to answer questions at any point along the way or as we conclude. So I think it's helpful, and I know we don't have to spend a lot of time on this, but helpful to get some of the context for why changes to the funding allocation formulas have made sense to the higher education Coordinating Commission. And I'll start with the context and 40-40-20, of course, the state goal expressed here on the left-hand side. Where are we today? Well, when we look at our entire working age population, we're close on the upper 40, 31% of the 40. That middle 40, we estimate we're at about 17%. And then we have a lot, far more than we would like, who have completed high school but not earned a degree or have not completed high school, and that's the 42% and the 10% respectively. When we look at young adults, so this is now high schoolers, students who graduated, Oregonians who graduated high school or were expected to graduate high school in 2006, where are they today or as of 2013? Well, they're proceeding along the way towards that kind of middle bar, but they're not there yet, and some doubt actually whether they're making sufficient progress even to keep up with older adults. We do see increases year over year in these the 22% and the 5% estimates of the of higher education completion, but many still in that high school completion bar, not having completed high school or its equivalent. The most interesting and important part of this slide for today is really the next click, or next two clicks, which are these bars that I've now turned from black to a sort of mixed color. And these are students who have completed high school and have enrolled in college or university but not completed yet. And in fact, you see almost the majority of students who completed high school, whether in the that recent graduate or the working age population, have tried. They've enrolled. They've started at college or university but not completed. And we think there's terrific opportunity there. And the focus of our work on funding allocations really is completion. The final sort of piece of context here is the changing diversity of Oregon. This slide depicts our projections of high school graduates by race and ethnicity out to 2034. You'll see, of course, the increasing non-white population that you know is moving through our K-12 school system. As my staff knows, this I actually have some trouble with this slide because it is a slide that uses that makes projections based on current rates of high school completion. So it actually underrepresents the increasing diversity of Oregon, and we certainly hope that the achievement gaps in K-12 will diminish. If they do, you'll actually see these bars, the non-white population, the non-white graduate population, grow increasingly, even more than this slide reflects. So the HEX responsibility related to funding. Of course, the legislature, you all appropriate dollars. You decide how much the state will invest biannually in our community colleges and our public universities. The HEC then determines under this statute and several others the rules that govern the allocation of those state resources to our 17 community colleges and our 7 public universities, as well as to student access programs. And we're required to develop those formulas in consultation with the institutions. This statutory mechanism, of course, is in contrast to K-12, where the allocation formula, the distribution formula, is in statute, not subject to a board or commission. But for higher ed, historically and today, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission determines how state resources are to be allocated once you've determined how much. So what is outcomes-based funding? A few sort of bullet points here. Outcomes-based funding is a model for distributing state resources that links that distribution to state educational attainment goals. It directs state investments to completions, in this the case I'll describe, including course completions, degree and certificate completions. It's designed to reward and reinforce institutional investments and student support services, and it's focused on achieving equity goals. And you'll see in a moment how these principles and goals are threaded through the work that we've done on the public university formula. Oregon is not unique or original in its effort to shift some of our higher education funding to an outcomes basis. 25 states currently have some form of outcomes-based funding for higher ed, and 9 more are currently developing them. And you'll note here the recent adoptions in Colorado and Arizona of outcomes-based models for funding distribution. So, in summary, outcomes-based funding is a method for the distribution of state resources. It's not a substitute for the need for additional state resources. This does not add anything to the pie. It merely distributes resources in a way that our commission believes is more likely to help accomplish state goals, but it is not a substitute for needing additional state resources. It's an appropriate mechanism or an appropriate alternative to tight state oversight of institutions. And I know we're going to talk about governance later in this hearing, but of course the state has moved to give our public universities greater autonomy. Part of the complement to that was to say the state will back off of institutional control, but we will be more outcomes focused with our distribution of dollars. And finally, the aims of outcomes funding should be modest. We should not expect this. This is not a panacea. This is not a cure-all. This is not going to change the world overnight. They should reflect the state's particular higher education context. So I'm going to talk about the work that we've done with the university funding formula. The commission adopted a new allocation model for our public universities last spring. It's in place for this fiscal year, the current fiscal year. So state distribution of dollars today to public universities is following outcomes to some extent. You'll see how we're phasing that in starting this year in a few slides. Brian Fox, the HECS director for public university finances, in the room. And if any questions get too technical, he's the mastermind here and can help me out, bail me out. So this slide, and really the top bar of it, describes the three kind of tranches of funding that's included within our new funding model, which we call the Student Success and Completion Model, or SSCM. So these are three sort of ways in which funding is delivered under the new funding rules. One of them is through mission differentiation funding, and this is really line item funding that recognizes the uniqueness of our institutions. Some of them are regional universities that require particular kinds of support in order to deal with the lesser economies of scale and other challenges and opportunities that they face. We have, of course, research components at all of our universities, but particularly at our three largest, and then public service missions that each university has. So line item funding that we've carried over from the existing formula or the pre-existing formula that reflects some distinctions between the universities. Part two of the new formula is really a carryover of the old formula, which is, in a sense, enrollment funding. This is activity-based funding. And we've maintained that tranche within this new formula, but it diminishes over time, and you'll see that in a moment. What's new about the funding formula is this third bullet point, completion funding, that focuses some of the state investment on degree and certificate completion at every level, undergraduate and graduate, with particular emphasis on underrepresented student populations and priority degree areas. There are transition mechanisms in place to smooth the path towards fully implementing this. I'll talk about those a little more in a couple of slides. We've also, and it's sort of related to the smoothing, we're using three-year rolling averages for each piece of the data. This is an improvement over the prior formula, the resource allocation model, that saw a lot of instability as a result of the fact it used only annual data. I see a question.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ben, could you give us an example of mission differentiation funding as it pertains to the regional universities versus the others in the system?
Yeah, Representative Johnson. Chair Reed, so our regional institutions, there's basically a block of funding that is a recognition of the fact that they are regional institutions. They have certain lesser opportunities with respect to economies of scale. Mm-hmm. So it's analogous to sort of small school funding that just comes off the top of the larger public university support fund and is provided to our four regional and technical universities. And I'm sure there's more detail that we could add to that if you'd like.
For instance, more of a per student allocation?
Representative Johnson, Chair Reed, I don't believe actually that it's per student. You want to come up?
Oh. Mr. Chair, for the record, Brian Fox, Director of University Budget and Finance for the HEC, Representative Johnson. There is, I don't want to get too technical in this discussion, but there's a small tranche that's actually, if an institution is below a set FTE or full-time equivalent student, then they receive funding for the amount that they're below that full-time. So there is some per-student funding. It's kind of like a reverse per-student funding. So until they hit, I believe it's 7,500 FTE, good, they get some amount of dollars, recognizing that as an institution is smaller, they don't hit those sort of economies of scale.
It's not unlike, in some way, the small school supplement that it's in play in K-12, but just a different...
Right. That's what I heard Ben say. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you.
Representative Rudin?
Might be a good time to follow up on that. How do you, in this formula, differentiate between those schools that require much more, say, materials, high-tech equipment, you know, specialized equipment, compared to some other school that might not be...
Representative Reed and Chair Reed, there are several ways in which the funding allocation formula does that. One way is on a sort of per course basis, where certain types of courses are in the enrollment in the activity based funding portion of this formula. Certain more expensive courses are weighted accordingly. We're actually, and there's a later slide that reflects our work to update that cost weighting, but we examine costs, and that's built into the formula with extra dollars delivered for courses that are more expensive.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
So the next three slides are really an articulation of the three tranches, and so I'm not going to go into them in detail. I'm just going to click through slides 10, 11, and 12. But this slide is on what I described and what Representative Johnson asked about, the mission differential allocation that comes essentially off the top to reflect the differences between our public universities. In a sense, this is sort of base funding. It's not particularly associated with FTE. It's not associated with completion or enrollment. It is really core base funding for our institutions that reflects some of their distinctions. Then the activity-based or enrollment funding that we've carried over from the old formula that funds enrollment in courses for all resident students. And I noted in this final box our work to update the cost weighting factors that are incorporated into this as they have been in the past.
What can you tell us about the scheduling on that last box?
The work group is beginning its work now, and I think is on an ambitious timeline for spending the next several months attempting to update the cost weighting and bring that back to the commission for recommendation. And then finally, this is that third tranche, the new piece, which is completion focused. Again, to reiterate, degrees at all levels for resident students, bachelor's through PhDs, as well as graduate certificates. I said for resident students, I do have to know if PhD students, we don't distinguish between resident and non-resident. Both are funded, but at every other level, it's resident students only. Cost adjustments made to reflect program duration, program type, and for transfer students, obviously an institution that's only serving a student for the final couple of years of that student's bachelor's degree, for example, incurs less expense, and so we actually adjust the completion payment to reflect that. And then these third and fourth horizontal bars, really important. Additional weighting provided for students who complete from traditionally underserved student populations, including low-income, underrepresented minority, rural, and veteran students. These are weights. They're significant. They're added for the completion of those students. Likewise, weights that are significant, and this is also a partial response to Representative Reardon's question, provided for students who complete in areas of critical need for the state, which we've determined at the outset to be in the fields of, in STEM fields, in healthcare, and in the preparation of educators for bilingual classrooms. So three areas where the commission along with our institutions, have determined there's a particular need, and so we're putting particular weight behind completion in those fields.
Representative McEwen has a question.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Hi, Mr. Cannon. How are you this morning?
Very good. Thank
good.
You.
It's been a while. On the selection of how you are weighting the STEM healthcare and bilingual education, it's come to my attention in my neck of the woods that we have a significant problem in finding math teachers, high school math teachers. How are those four areas selected? What determines that those are areas that are going to receive weighting, and has that been considered?
Yeah, Representative McEwen, Chair Reed, it's a good question. The commission looked over a year ago at the employment department data about areas of job need and opportunity and projections over the coming 5 to 10 years, and that was a partial basis for the priority degree areas. We see gaps in our projections between gaps between the projected degree production and job opportunity. And mm-hmm. so we can sort of line those up and say, wow, there appear to be some big holes in some particular areas, and these were included. That said, I think the commission recognizes that this particular piece of the formula, you know, is one that will require continuous reexamination as job markets change, as the labor force changes. This will require updating to reflect new needs, new opportunities, new gaps.
Go ahead. Quickly,
so, please. response to need and flexibility in that is built in, so that those things can be addressed as they pop up.
Representative McEwen, Chair Reed, yes. One of the advantages of having the formula located at the commission is our ability to update it, quickly, annually, or as.
Thank you,
Representative Hayden.
Chair Reed, thank you. Would you quickly define veteran students? What is the definition?
Representative Hayden, Chair Reed, I won't satisfy you, I don't think, on the technical, in part because this has been one of our more challenging technical issues. The veteran student definition, I think, has not been well established at our institutions. I know that we've worked with them to try to establish a consistent across the board a definition, and be happy to follow up with you on where that stands today. It was important to the commission that veteran students receive this extra weight within the formula, and we moved forward even in the absence of certainty that we had a highly consistent and standardized definition for veteran students, but I think we've made progress towards that, and be happy to update you on the work of the campuses on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, could you make that information to the committee?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Of course. Okay. Please continue.
Okay, so this is sort of the meat of it. An allocation formula divides a pie, and so a pie chart here is appropriate. This is the proportion of resident student credit hours. This is our enrollment pie chart for our 7 public universities. And under the old formula, to maximize state resources, one had to maximize the share of one's institution's, the amount of this pie that your institution took. So this was the old model, if you will. If you want to increase resources from the state, hope that your enrollment grows more than others, and do anything you can to maximize the share of state students that your university enrolls. Under the current newly adopted formula, we have really four ways for universities to manage or attempt to manage the resources they get from the state. The first, on the top left, is identical to the previous. It's enrollment. It's the proportion of resident student credit hours that the institution enrolls. But with the introduction of these new elements related to completion, now universities are also trying to maximize their share of these other three pies, which are all related to completion. and the proportion of resident degree completions, the proportion of resident targeted degrees, so this is the STEM healthcare bilingual education, and the proportion of resident targeted subpopulation, or those low-income veteran, rural, and minority students that the institution graduates. And these factors now combine to form the university's allocation. And you can see that different universities do better on different dimensions of this new formula. But this creates, we think this is a more, a landscape, a funding landscape that better reflects our institutional missions. It doesn't hinge the entire distribution on enrollment, and as a result, it does a better job of reflecting their values and priorities as well as the state's. So we're in a transition period. We're using stop loss and stop gain to help ensure that there isn't a abrupt funding change, either downside or upside, as we transition to the new model. We're phasing it in, and over subsequent years, the completion component of this will constitute 60%.
How long till that's fully phased in and the stop losses and stop gains are out?
It will be out in the fiscal year 2018. So that's what this okay. shows. I'm just going to go ahead and put this up here. So the three tranches of, I'll start with the pie charts and then we'll come up back up to the numbers. But the three tranches of funding that I've been describing, the mission differentiation, the activity-based funding or enrollment funding, and the completion funding, are being phased in over a four-year period, starting with this one. And you'll see that the completion funding will grow to 49% in 2018 of the entire distribution. It really is taking the place of the activity-based or enrollment-based funding, which will shrink from 66% today to 33% in 2018. And what this slide doesn't contain is where we were in 2015, but essentially activity-based, the green here would have represented, there would have been practically no completion-based funding in 2015. So we've added that for 2016, and we're diminishing the activity-based funding over time. In the top, you'll see a sort of estimate of what the dollars are associated with completion as the new formula gets introduced and phased in. And you'll see by 2018, and this contains a variety of, you know, number of assumptions related to state investment and enrollment and so on. But by 2018, degree completion will be worth about $9,000 under the formula, with additional funding of up to about $3,000 for underrepresented students who complete, and then per credit hour funding diminishing to about $24 per credit hour from 39 this year. So another way of looking at the phase-in. We understand that this is a significant change. It has consequences, some of them we hope intended, and perhaps some that are unintended. We are committed to an evaluation process that will re-examine this and update and modify as necessary. And that's what's described here, both a short-term and a long-term, short-term sort of smaller evaluation and a longer-term comprehensive evaluation. And working very closely with the institutions on that. It's been very gratifying, frankly, to work with the institutions on this initial year of implementation and to see the kinds of conversations and work that's occurring. Now, the state's significant reinvestment in public universities this year is a significant part of the reason why we're seeing more resources directed at student success and completion. Alongside this funding allocation model, we think that's a very, very healthy and positive thing. Some of those activities are described here, efforts at universities to structure pathways from high school to degree completion, increased attention to and resources for financial aid, remission, scholarships, increased advising and mentoring, information and data system to identify and target support to at-risk students. We are continuing to meet with leadership to discuss the model and its implementation. We're providing technical support to those at the universities who are responsible for working on their end with it. And just noting that continued investment by the legislature is key to making this work. Again, in my conversations with board members, with presidents, with other administrators at universities, the overwhelming message has been, wow, we really need to focus resources on underrepresented student completion. That is key to success in this model. And I think that's the type of conversation we hope they're having. It's too early to know, frankly, is this moving the needle? We just started implementing it. But we think the conversations that are occurring are the right ones and are very, very heartening. So we'll stop there.
Thank you very much. Any last questions? Representative Gallegos.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cannon. I'm curious. I appreciate your comments early on about the issue with regard to K-12 graduation, particularly with communities of color. I mean, the black community, the Latino community are still touching almost 50% not graduating. So clearly that'll make a difference. But I'm also curious about and very impressed with your efforts to provide some outcome assessment of this aspirational goal of 40-40-20. And we spent some time in this committee recognizing that we also want to make sure that students that aren't getting into college or going to college, but our career sort of and our trade school folks, whom I assume a lot of these communities of color who we get to graduate are going to be going into those programs. Is it the purview of the HEC to also apply this outcome-based assessment to that group as well, or is that going to be handled by somebody else?
Representative Gallegos, Chair Reed, the primary sources of state funding that the HEC is responsible for allocating are the public university dollars that I've described here, the community college support dollars that we continue to allocate on a strictly on an enrollment basis, an FTE basis, and the financial aid dollars that we distribute through the opportunity grant in partnership with the legislature and a bill you passed this session. We're making some updates there. I think some of the programs and opportunities that you've described are ones that community colleges sit really right in the middle of. And the commission retains its interest in working with the community colleges, the legislature, the governor's office on modifying, updating the community college formula to reflect some of the same kinds of priorities around student success, and in particular the success of underrepresented students, especially in targeted and high-need areas. Again, today's community college formula treats every FTE identically, whether that's a low-income, rural student of color or not, whether that's in a high-cost healthcare-related training field or in a general education field. An FTE is an FTE, and we are certainly interested in continuing to have those conversations with many stakeholders about the possibility of updating that community college formula to reflect some of these principles.
Well, can I follow up a bit? I mean, where would the rest of it be assessed? I mean, you're talking about the community college piece, but what about, say, I mean, unions have trade schools. There are a number of different entities that provide that kind of training. Are we not going to also look at outcome data with regard to those in terms of support and so on?
Representative Gallegos, Chair Reed, I think it's important certainly to look at outcomes data for in regard to all of this work. The HEC's responsibility and frankly funding comes primarily through the tranches that I identified. There are dollars that the state invests through BOLI and apprenticeship, through the Department of Employment, and through the HEC in some workforce activities that are, I think, important. And we do monitor very tightly the federal dollars that we're responsible for deploying through Perkins and WIOA and other workforce-related
activities. Just a final comment. I just appreciate what you're doing with the HEC and the assessment you just were talking about. But it'd be great to sort of replicate this with that other section.
Absolutely.
That's what I'm just thinking.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Johnson, quickly,
thank
please.
You, Mr. Chair. Ben, what's been the response from the universities, and what about this new funding model might they be most anxious about?
Representative Johnson, Chair Reed, of course, I'm hesitant to speak for the universities. I think there's certainly increasing understanding of the formula, increasing awareness both of the opportunities it creates and the challenges that it will create for some institutions. Again, I would characterize my conversations that I've had with some of the boards and with some of the administrators as really sort of focused on the opportunity side. Like, wow, we really need to focus on these students. We need to invest in student support and completion in order to take advantage of the model. And I think those are the right conversations to have. The concerns really fall along a couple of lines. I mean, one is a concern really about academic quality, that a funding model that invests explicitly in and creates incentives around degree completion will somehow create incentives to sort of just hand out degrees and certificates, right? So we took that very seriously, that concern very seriously from the outset, have worked with faculty, with provosts, with the institutions to incorporate academic quality measures into our annual evaluations of universities, as well as to make sure we understood the other mechanisms that are in place, accreditation, faculty control of curriculum and grading and assessment, that we think are very likely to maintain academic quality. But we appreciate there is a risk, and that we need to be attentive to that. We absolutely don't want to see the value of a degree diminished as a result of this formula and any pressure that a faculty member might feel to you know, hand out a grade, a good grade, or a certificate or a degree as a result of it. So that's one concern. You know, I think concerns around equity. Again, you've seen the ways that we've tried to address those in here. But again, this work would be highly counterproductive if it resulted in universities trying to figure out who the easiest students to serve, those who are most likely to complete, are, and going after them, right? That would be the antithesis of what we're trying to achieve. But it can happen. A poorly constructed outcomes formula could merely give an incentive to an institution to find those students who are most likely to succeed, put your resources there, and scoop up the dollars. And that's why, in part, the equity weights are so important. There are other concerns that are specific to particular institutions. The University of Oregon, along with some others, but especially the U of O, has been especially interested in updating the cost weighting. I described concern that the 15-year-old methodology that we use to establish cost weights it doesn't reflect current realities of costs of various programs, and there are other technical issues that will continue to be a subject, I think, of some discussion.
Thank you.
Representative Rudin?
Yeah, just real quick. I really support what you're doing. It's a tremendous project. Just wondering, though, at the end of 3 years, are there any institutions that might anticipate a reduction in their budgets?
Representative Rudin, Chair Reed, that will depend on your body's ability to and willingness to support higher education funding and university funding specifically. Under the current biennial budget that we're implementing every university is seeing a healthy, probably not sufficient, but a healthy uptick in state resources under this new distribution model. But that is the result primarily of your very significant reinvestment in our public universities. The subsequent biennium, it will depend on the total appropriation that this legislature chooses to make.
Thank you. I think it's a good spot to end. And, of course, we'll have lots of opportunity, I suspect, in February to continue this discussion as your work continues. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So to close the informational hearing on outcomes-based funding and open an open informational hearing on the OER grant program, invite Dan Finley, Veronica Duhon, and Donna Lewelling. I've continued to feel like this was one of the things we did in our session that of which most of us are most proud. So I've been looking forward to this update. And glad you're here.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Chair Reed, members of the committee, good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, Dan Finley, Director, HEC Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, joined today by my colleague Donna Lewelling. Our colleague, Veronica Duhon, unfortunately, due to unforeseen circumstances, will not be here this morning.
Thank you.
HEC is working intentionally within its offices and with our institutional partners to approach the work associated with HB 2871 via a collaborative and coordinated approach that will leverage activities that are currently happening not only statewide, but across the nation.
I'm going to begin this update by talking to you about four key components.
Technical difficulties.
Understood.
Always fun, Jerry. Thank you for your patience. There we go.
And there we go. So four key components, as you can see on the slide. First of all, HB 2871 establishes the Open Education Resources Grant Program within the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, requires the HEC to employ an OER resource specialist, requires public post-secondary institutions to prominently designate courses whose course materials exclusively consist of open or free materials. Also directs the HEC in coordination with public post-secondary institutions to identify OERs for 15 courses that are high enrollment, general educational disciplines, and that are capable of being transferred among public post-secondary institutions, therefore giving it the greatest utility.
So I'll go ahead and take over. For the record, my name's Donna Lewelling. I'm the Academic and Student Affairs Policy Specialist for the HEC. So as in an effort to ensure the intentional leveraging of resources, the HEC has formed the OER Steering Committee. The committee will consist of librarians, faculty, administrators, students, bookstores, and your very own representative, Wisnet, will be participating as well. They will assist in providing advice and guidance to the HEC staff regarding the development of the request for proposals associated with the OER grant program and other matters as the work moves forward. It is anticipated that as the committee moves forward, it will have its first meeting in late November, early December. The OER grant program itself will be designed under the guidance and advice of the steering committee. The program will work to maximize the use of existing resources and activities within the state of Oregon and across the nation in the area of open educational resources. It is anticipated that the request for proposal will be released in late winter, with institutions being selected in early spring. So we're hoping to get the money out the door early next year. With regards to the OER resource specialist, work is underway to fill the position as identified by the legislation. The HEC anticipates opening the position in the next few weeks, with hiring being completed near the first of the year. This particular position will work very closely with other open educational resource specialists and librarians throughout the state to leverage other institutional activities and resources to ensure the greatest possible outcome for the House Bill 2871 funding allocation. As you may know, course catalogs themselves are produced at individual institutions. However, the HEC will look to the OER Steering Committee to make recommendations regarding statewide codes that could be considered by institutions as they designate courses whose course material exclusively consists of open or free textbooks or other low-cost or no-cost course materials. The completion of these recommendations is anticipated in late winter to allow time for institutions to consider them for incorporation in their 2016-17 academic year catalogs.
Can I interrupt for a moment
Sure.
on that question? I appreciate the way you said consideration. Can you help me understand the difference between consideration and the statutory requirement to prominently identify?
So institutions could choose to prominently identify in a variety of manners. So in other words, they could one institution could choose to designate one way, and another institution could choose to designate another way.
Okay.
My concern would be that if we had multiple ways of designating things, it would be difficult for students to kind right. of identify that. So we'd be looking to the steering committee to make some recommendations so that institutions could consider some consistency as they look to coding their catalogs.
Understood, I think. So essentially you're trying to limit the number of ways they could, striking the right balance of allowing some flexibility but not too much?
Is correct.
That, okay.
That is correct.
Thank you.
In addition, probably the most significant part of the legislation itself is the development of the OER courses. In preparation for the first OER steering committee, staff has begun to research which courses may meet the criteria of being in high enrollment general educational disciplines and which may be capable of being transferred. Upon preliminary analysis, these courses appear to be in disciplines such as writing, psychology, sociology, biology, and math. As you can guess, this information should be very valuable as the HEC begins to outline the grant program and starts to really start to focus the areas in which efforts should be taking place in. We also believe that this information will become very important as we develop the corresponding RFP. In addition, the HEC has developed a web page framework to house course textbooks and corresponding materials. This page will be accessible by anyone wishing to use the OER content that is developed through the OER grant program. While it is still under construction, it is anticipated that it will be a valuable resource in the coming months and years. In addition, we have purchased additional software to aid in the organization of materials associated with the development and peer review of the OER course materials. In closing, I just want to note how excited we are about this work, and the HEC is looking to build a strong foundation to the program by leveraging resources and by building on content area expertise. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Gallegos.
It's funny, I hadn't thought about this before, but to whom are these resources accessible?
They will be accessible to everyone, actually, because they'll be on an open source licensing agreement. They'll be open to everyone in the world.
So we put in the bill the Creative Commons, as you may remember, Dr. Cable Green, who was here.
So at a private institution, I can still access these?
Yes, Vice Chair Gallegos, yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. Representative Nierman, sorry.
Thank you, Chair Reed. So the OER coordinator that you're going to hire, what's your vision of what the task is of that person? What's their job description look like?
Rep. Nierman, Chair Reed, the bill itself is actually pretty descriptive around the tasks that this particular position will do, but it really will be about building capacity across the state and also building faculty buy-in around open educational resources, working with institutions hand-in-hand to develop open educational resources, and also specifically focusing in on the development of these 15 courses that are called out within the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
So, Nierman, I recall our conversation being about helping faculty access the open education resources that already exist,
right.
So we're not having to recreate things and letting them remix and repurpose the stuff that already exists.
Good. One of the things that I went to a thing at Oregon State, I think you were there too,
uh-huh.
There, and I was talking to a professor there, and I was asking him what are some of the barriers to, not just to create the resources, but to just have a professor who's teaching a class adopt the resources. And he said that that a lot of it is just awareness, because the McGraw-Hill guy is going to come and give you free textbooks and take you out to coffee and all that. And there's not really, I hate to use the word salesman for OER. So I hope that that position has at least a little slice of that in it. So.
Good. Representative Nierman, Chair Reed, absolutely, that is the plan.
Good, thanks.
Cheering and steering.
Representative Reed.
Just for the sake of those who are watching online, the vast crowds out there, could you define OER, what it is, who it benefits? I'm pretty sure we all know. But.
So I actually, Representative Rudin, Chair Reed, I do not have the actual language in front of me basically open educational resources are resources that are developed that are free and accessible using online content. So they're just free textbooks and associated course materials.
Thank you.
Yes.
Very good. One last question. Anything that we got wrong in the bill that we need to try to adjust in our February session?
So, Chair Reed and members of the committee, at this time, I believe it's too early to say, but I think we are doing a really good job at the HEC to try to build a strong foundation. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that the OER steering committee will let us know if we've missed the mark, but I think the most important thing is that you are allowing for institutional involvement and institutional freedom to determine which ones of these courses we should be working on.
Good. So. Thank you. Representative Wisnett, thanks for the announcement. You're our liaison. You'll tell us what we got wrong, we trust.
Well, I think the whole committee was very impressed with this and the briefing that the gentleman from Washington that got us excited. And the chair, you know, led the way with the bill and getting it done. I'm disappointed we got less money than we asked for to do more courses, but it's a great start, and I think it's going to really help Oregon. We were impressed with the Oregon State lady also who has already been doing this at Oregon State. So.
Yep. So I did want to note, Chair Reed and Representative Wisnett, both Cable Green and Diane Fisher from OSU are on our steering committee.
Fantastic to hear. That's great. Yep. Well, we'll depend on you to get us started, and then hopefully we'll be back for additional funding.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Close the hearing on the Open Education Resource Grant Program implementation and open a hearing on review of university governance. Now, as we get started, Ben Cannon is going to get us started. Please come forward as he gets started. I want to just note that we have a lot of people to hear from in this hearing. And as I talked to a number of people in preparation for the hearing, I think what our intent here is really to hear an update on how the transition is going. My words now, but to assess how appropriately we're striking the balance between autonomy and flexibility or autonomy and centralization, those kinds of questions. I think we are not as interested in specific instances, but more a broad overview of how things are going. As an indication of whether there's work to be done for us during the February session. Having said all of that, please keep in mind our constrained time as well, and we'll get a chance to hear from everybody. Mr. Cannon, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and I will be very brief in keeping with your admonition at the outset, Chair Reed. So, Oregon Higher Education Governance, I'm really primarily here just to describe what has occurred over the last 4 or 5 years, and it is remarkable, the changes to Oregon's higher education landscape. And I've divided this into two parts. I think your topic today really is focused on the latter, which is university governance. I do want to note the significant efforts that have been made over the last 4 years to create higher levels, greater levels of state coordination. Each of the five offices on the left-hand side are Office of Degree Authorization and Private Career Schools Licensing Unit, both of which are focused on private and career schools. The State Board of Higher Education and the Oregon University System's responsibility for university coordination, the State Board of Education's responsibility for community colleges and the Community College and Workforce Development Department that it oversaw, and the Oregon Student Access Commission all have been blended into a single agency led by a single commission. So we've gone from four boards that were responsible for higher education to one. We've gone from four agencies, including ODE, OSAC, CCWD, and the Oregon University System and its Chancellor's Office, to one, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, that has responsibility for coordinating, not governing, but coordinating higher ed. Again, your interest, I think, is primarily on the university side and, of course, the recent changes that took the State Board of Higher Education and the Oregon University System's governance responsibilities and parceled them out to seven new university boards of trustees. But this is a remarkable very complicated set of changes that have occurred over the last 4 years. It results in a system where this data is a couple of years old. The HEC has certain kinds of responsibilities for each of the entities that are on the left-hand side. I've sort of noted a partial note of what those responsibilities are, the number of institutions and enrollment that's involved. My final remarks before I let the folks who I think you're most interested in hearing talk about this work from their standpoint. This is really recent. I was so struck last week to see the announcement or a story about the first meeting, the first official meeting of Eastern Oregon University's Board of Trustees last month in October. They met for the first time as a sort of official board. They were appointed a year ago, but then there was a ramp up to their taking over of full responsibilities July 1st. They met for the first time October. So they are just at the beginning. We are collectively at the very outset of this new endeavor. Number two, this is extraordinary change, and to my knowledge, nothing has broken yet. It really is remarkable that the work of our universities, the work of our state, continues without clear breakage. The gears of state governance, state coordination, and university governance continue running despite this very complicated legal and governance transition that's taken place over the last couple of years. And it's a real testament to some of the folks in the room on the university side, as well as many at the state, our own agency included, but not limited to our own agency, to help make sure that this work, that students continue to be served in the state. Point three, and then I just have one more, but point three, the state-level coordination that is described on the top part of this through the HEC, I think is already beginning to pay off. Our work on the Oregon Promise, the Free Community College Bill, is better, our state work on that, because we have CCWD, the Student Access Office, OSAC, our research and data team, all working collectively under the same umbrella to help make that program work for students. We've brought those resources together in-house, and we're making better decisions as a result with higher levels of coordination. There are other examples of that at the state level. Finally, when it comes to sort of issues or concerns or things to watch, I think, again, it is very early. I think that as a commission and as you as a legislature on the university side, to be mindful of the fact that creating new boards, creating separate institutions may create challenges around resources and efficiencies. We have to watch that, right? We have to be mindful of the desire not to duplicate unnecessarily. That's part of the HEC statutory charter, and certainly something that I know that you care about. And then we also have to seize this opportunity for even greater levels of coordination between and among our universities. It's actually very striking the extent to which the universities are, in many respects, working more closely together, more collegially today than they were before the breakup. It's maybe counterintuitive. You say, well, now they each have their own boards. Well, yes, but they are coming together because of that independence, I think, in some interesting ways. Just last week, our commission heard a presentation given by two university presidents on behalf of all seven universities. And they do that frequently. They don't have a chancellor. They don't have an overseer. So they share tasks among each other. They come to the commission. They send one representative to the commission. There's a lot of planning and work that has to go on and cooperation to make that possible. And I think it's a real testament to them. I think it's something that we should be continually looking for and noting if or when it doesn't exist. But I think today, so far, so good.
Very good. Thank you. So let's start with Thomas Morrill, Devin Backstrom, and Pam Miller, please. So you three can pick the order you'd like to talk in, and please begin by introducing yourself for a record, and as you can be concise, we'll appreciate it.
Yeah, my name is Devin Backstrom, and it looks like I've been volunteered to go first. So.
Very good.
So hello, y'all. My name is Devin Backstrom, Chair Reed, members of the committee. I'm the Academic Affairs Director of ASPSU, and I've come this morning to testify on the issue of governance. I'm a non-traditional student. I was raised by a single mother. I want to become a doctor, and I hope the challenges that I face at my university aren't going to prevent that. However, this testimony isn't really about me. It's about governance that's affecting all students within our state. Since the recent passing of legislation SB 270, few years ago, PSU and the other universities have moved towards this Board of Trustees model that we're talking about. I fear that the Board of Trustees model is more like a private corporation as opposed to a state-administered agency. This means institutions have individualized control of their tuition and a business model which prioritizes Oregon at a far lesser degree than ever before. The HEC acts as oversight somewhat within the universities, but only if the universities try to raise tuition more than 5% in a given year. Even this is unlikely because HEC does not view itself as an accountability body. There's no voting student on the HEC to shift this perspective either. Universities have increased tuition and fees on average of 4.5%, 4.5% a year for the last 40 years, meaning the 5% limit is far too high, while inflation has been fairly stable at 2 to 3%. Slowly but surely, 5% tuition increases have caused prices to soar, making college less and less affordable. The reality is that from an administrative and business perspective, it makes a good deal of sense to continuously raise your tuition as high as you can. Your budget grows, your company grows, and you compete better in your environment. Competition that universities are already running into. You might always say that this price increase is a temporary price increase, but until you've exceeded price elasticities, people don't stop paying, and it doesn't make any sense for management to stop charging. Institutions now have the flexibility to continue to give themselves a 4.99% increase with relatively little state or board oversight, pretty much continuously. Even with the state legislature increasing funding last year massively, almost every university raised their undergrad tuition and fees in excess of 4.5%. PSU did 3.8%, which is still greater than inflation. If students, faculty, and staff had increased say, and by increased say I mean voting seats on the HEC, voting seats within the Board of Trustees, instead of their current one, we might see a difference. If business interests and executive management had less of a say on the Board of Trustees instead of their current 11 to 13, we might see a difference. If the Board of Trustees members were not trained by the management that they oversee, we might also see a difference. If Board of Trustees members were not allowed to increase tuition beyond inflation without state approval, we might see a difference. As it stands, there's relatively little to no accountability for the Board of Trustees. The Board of Trustees believes that their role is to facilitate what executive management wants. Faculty, staff, and students are seen as an irritation, not a contribution. We've already seen what these boards will do with regards to OHSU. If you don't want Oregon's only claim to fame to be the most expensive education in the country, please hear what we have to say today. Having voting rights, having oversight, having transparency helps shift priorities on these boards. Everyone prioritizes their own needs. Students prioritize low tuition. Faculty prioritize their students' success. And executive management often does not share these priorities. It's not because they're callous either. It's not like they're just raising tuition because they want to. It's built into their job descriptions. They're not doing their job if they're not actually advocating for these increases. The only real option to win our tuition fight, to come to a model that works for everyone, is to institutionalize good policy with individuals who can reliably shift that conversation back to what's important to all of Oregon, not just the business model that they're currently running with. Otherwise, millions that we raise in state and federal investment only slow down what is essentially speaking an ever-worsening issue. The balance of voting rights on the boards is certainly a tricky issue, and I'm not saying that that's not a hard issue to talk about. But when you give a group which is responsible for paying for roughly 3/4 of a university's budget, less than a tenth of the say, you're tacitly approving of exploitation of that group. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
Thank you, Chair Reed. My name is Thomas Morrill. I am a graduate teaching assistant at Oregon State University. And I'm also the vice president of bargaining for the Coalition of Graduate Employees, which is the labor union that represents all graduate employees on OSU campus. I'd like to testify today with our experiences at the OSU Board of Trustees. Since the inception of the seven boards, we have faced some issues bringing our needs to the board to be addressed. Primarily, we note that the OSU Board of Trustees tends to meet towards the end of the academic term, if not during finals week itself, which poses many problems for people who are students and educators, as this is the busiest time of the term. When we are able to attend the board meetings, the public comment sections are typically taken at the end of the hearings after a decision has already been made. Because graduate employees lack a guaranteed seat in the body, we are restricted to the public comment sections when we want to bring our needs before the board. And quite frequently we find that the challenges that we would like the board to fix in the governance of Oregon State University fall on deaf ears. We would look for a process in which we can engage with the board more early as it makes its decisions and addresses the issues that face Oregon State University. Graduate employees are a very large group that are distinct from the other types of employees of Oregon State University. We have both a student role as we are enrolled, and we have an employment role. We have responsibilities towards the education of Oregon State University students. We have responsibilities towards the continuation of Oregon State University research. And we have a unique situation with our immediate supervisors, who most often are the very same people that we hope to become peers with in the future, which puts a very different spin on that relationship. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Ms. Miller.
Good morning.
And our microphones are actually quite powerful, so you don't need to lean into it. It'll work perfectly right there.
Thank you. Chair Reed and members of the committee, for the record, I am Pam Miller, president of the Portland State Chapter of the American Association of University Professors, and our union represents 1,280 full-time faculty members. This is my 24th academic year at Portland State University. I'm a full tenured professor in the School of Social Work. My research and scholarship focus on best practices for social workers that provide services in end-of-life and palliative care. I worked as a hospice social worker for many years in Appalachia, and upon receiving my PhD in 1992 from the University of Pittsburgh, I joined the faculty at PSU. I'm a Fulbright Scholar in Latvia 2001 and a recipient of Rotary International Higher Education Teacher Grant in Krakow, Poland 2009. I'm also a first-generation college student. Thank you for this opportunity to testify about experiences with the Board of Trustees at Portland State. We realize the role of the board is new and that we're all learning in this process and during this transition. My observations are divided into five categories, and I have a summary statement. Number one, the board only meets four times a year. Although four committees work during the academic year as well, the full board meetings are very long, and the agenda is often loaded with extremely important decisions that need discussion and engagement that appear to sometimes be rushed. And I agree, the meetings do tend to happen usually right at the end of the quarter or during finals week, which makes it a little bit more difficult for faculty and students to be there for the entire meeting. My second point is that the board members are not very accessible to the PSU community. There's not a way to contact them. The board secretary can forward or carry messages, but there should be some way to contact each board member directly. Their website provides no contact information. We do not expect personal email addresses, yet a PSU email address seems reasonable. Point three, although the board represents a small slice of the campus, alums and donors, a faculty member, a student, staff member, for which we very much respect their service, the majority of its members are not part of the everyday life of the PSU community. They do not live or work on the campus. This limits their ability to understand deep-seated problems on our campus. So, for example, hunger is a concern on our campus, as in 2014, 59% of over 2,500 students were found to meet the definition of food insecurity. When this was presented to the board, a couple of members became almost indignant at these survey results. So this is a long way to say that instead of composing the board predominantly of people who are large donors to PSU, who we greatly appreciate, we need to also have civic leaders from the community to be on the board too, to provide some balance of perspective and power. Number four, employees of PSU have constricted opportunities to speak at board meetings, and we must sign up to speak during the first 30 minutes of the public comment time. I specifically asked as president of PSU AAUP if I could speak at each meeting as a regular agenda item to keep the board informed about its full-time faculty. The chair told me I could sign up for the public comment time or contact him personally and ask for consideration to be put on the agenda. I'm not the public at PSU. I work at PSU. And I'll add that during bargaining, I was permitted to speak at the September meeting of the Board of Trustees, and I assume I will speak at the December meeting because we are still bargaining our contract. I've never in the 24 years I've been employed at PSU had to sign up to speak at a working meeting. Number five, the board does not understand the policies that underpin PSU, specifically the PSU standards that evolved from the former OARs, particularly the section on conditions of service. The board does not understand our collective bargaining agreement and the subsequent conditions that must be followed. In summary, I'll say that the board is accountable to the president, or the president is accountable to the board. His voice is very dominant, particularly since the board is not easily accessible to students or to those who work or live at PSU. Aside from employee board members, employees, even those like me, who are leading a democratically chosen organization, do not have access except at the public comment period at the beginning of each board meeting. The board appears to need some education about how the university works, what its policies and practices are, but more importantly, to understand that on a university campus, we have faculty governance. This means that we all have access to each other. We communicate, we're transparent, and we're accountable to the campus. That's how higher education works. Remember, one of the pillars of governance is the opportunity to have robust debates and conversations about how the university works or does not work. I've been immersed in deliberations like this for what seems like a lifetime. PSU AAUP looks forward to more discussions about the role and work of the board, and we stand ready to work for changes that benefit the higher education community both in Portland and around the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Recognizing that we have more people to hear from, are there any quick questions for any of these three?
Thank you.
Representative Gallegos?
I just want to thank you for, you know, I think one of the things we're trying to, as we implement this new process, really get a sense then of what really is happening at the ground level. So thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Chair, just quickly for you, Mr. Chair, I'm just noticing that we don't have either board members or board chairs on the agenda today. Was that intentional? Or
I think we're just trying to get a representative sample of a variety of perspectives. I think the general counsel from PSU can, to some degree, cover that perspective. But I think by definition, whatever we're going to do is incomplete, just based on the fact that there's more people there and more people affected than we'll be able to hear from. So I appreciate the point. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up then, I'm probably going to mispronounce. U of O Professor Joseph Lowndes, Richard Kavanaugh, and Patrick Greiner, please. Apologies for, I'm sure, mispronouncing your name. And as before, you can, you three can decide who goes first. Please begin by introducing yourself, and appreciate your brevity.
Good morning, Chair Reed.
And if you could just move the microphone in your general direction. It doesn't have to be close, but if it's pointed at you, it would be great. Perfect.
Is that better?
Yes. Thank
okay.
you.
Good morning, Chair Reed and members of the House Higher Ed Innovation and Workforce Development Committee. My name is Richard Kavanaugh. I support students as a programmer analyst at Western Oregon University. I am a classified staff member and a member of SEIU 503. I'm not on the institutional board, as you mentioned, but I do attend their meetings, and I'm personally impressed by the makeup and diversity of our board. My sense is that the fellow true school boards are finding their way with similar successes and collegial feelings. I would like to quickly present some insights that have been gathered from other campuses and staff board representatives. As SEIU, along with student, faculty, and community voices, advocated in 2013 when the boards were started, governing boards work better when they include members of the main campus constituencies. These members provide a current on-campus perspective that off-campus trustees cannot. The outside independent entrepreneurial input that some governing board members offer will be more useful because it is informed by current practical knowledge of campus conditions. That is why faculty, student body members, and staff have an obligation to keep the non-campus board members well informed about what we see and hear, and why we should have an equal voice and vote on the boards. It may look at times to be advocacy, but it is our job to provide important insight and balance. We strongly support expanding membership of the campus constituencies because it would mean better board decisions overall. These positions should be in addition to the current maximum 14 trustees, thus ensuring that non-campus voices would still be in the majority. As staff members, we see graduate students and non-tenure track faculty as being underrepresented groups on the boards that could be tapped to fill these additional seats. We also support governing boards that do their work publicly and make it easy for the public to connect with them. I know that many boards chafe greatly about having to deliberate publicly. They hold public votes, but there is little in the way of discussion and deliberation in public, unlike what you would see at school board or city council meetings. Governing boards need to ensure that there is adequate notice of meetings and that all documents discussed and presented at board meetings are published. Also, their meetings need to be held at times that campus members and the public are more widely available, such as evenings and weekends. Since the boards have been given an extreme amount of independence and the HEC has only limited oversight responsibility, reviewing board performance will be challenging. The universities have just received extra money from the legislature for specific projects, and there should be a mechanism for reviewing how that money was spent and determining its effectiveness. The HEC should be able to evaluate boards on how well they're meeting their mission statements and their 40-40-20 goals, and be able to offer recommendations. Thank you for holding this informational hearing, and I'm open to any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
Hello, Chair Reed, committee members. My name is Patrick Greiner. I'm a graduate employee at University of Oregon and the Vice President of Communications for the Graduate Teaching Fellows Federation, which is the union that represents all the graduate employees on the University of Oregon campus. In regard to how successful the new governance model at the University of Oregon has been, I cannot speak from every perspective, but from the point of view of graduate employees, it seems to have fallen short on a few measures, several of which have been expressed already. The greatest of which, in my opinion, is that it is not fully representative and collaborative. as I mentioned, there are 1,500 graduate employees on campus. We fill a variety of roles. We teach more than a third of the courses. We perform research that's vital in many departments. And despite that, we do not have a voice on the Board of Trustees at University of Oregon. When we attempt to contact the Board of Trustees, it, like in many other cases, is only allowed to be done through public comment sessions. In the worst case scenario, which I think has already happened, this can end up in a strike, which happened last December. When we attempted to contact the Board of Trustees several times, and we were not enabled to email them or to distribute information to them at their meetings. So in summation, I think that we should take steps to try to make these boards more representative. We were told often that we had a student representative to speak for us at these meetings. I would just quickly like to point out that these student representatives do not have the experience of graduate employees. They are not teaching courses or performing lab work. And even as students, their experience is fundamentally different than that of the graduate student. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Sir.
Hi, good morning, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Joe Lowndes. I'm an associate professor of political science at the University of Oregon and a member of the Executive Council of United Academics, the faculty union representing 1,800 faculty at the University of Oregon, and associated with both AFT Oregon and the AAUP. I'm also currently the University of Oregon representative to the AOF. I appreciate this opportunity to testify, so thank you. In my political science courses, we explore questions of governance in relation to representation, accountability, communication, and the forging of shared goals. Students don't always find this as interesting as I do, but nevertheless. With respect to the Board of Trustees of the University of Oregon, I appreciate the opportunity to convey some concerns as well as hopes going forward. Faculty across campus remain hopeful about our still very young institutional board. We want to continue to believe that a local governing board can best know the university, can best understand its strengths and potential, as well as its distinct needs and challenges. Many UO faculty were persuaded by this vision in 2011. Events last year, however, raised concerns that the trustees did not have their ear to the faculty on matters of academic governance, especially in relation to the University of Oregon Constitution, until matters became quite contentious in the spring of 2014 and the fall of 2015. Or winter of 2015. There's yet great room for improvement in the communications between the trustees and faculty leaders in the Senate and United Academics. A Senate President report and a mere 2-minute public comment period provide too few channels for dialogue on important matters. This last September, the trustees, with all good intent, adopted a statement of governance and trustee responsibilities. In that resolution, we are properly reminded of the trustees' commitment to advance the mission of the university. We should also consider, as our boards develop, who ought to be represented on them. There's been a growing sentiment at the University of Oregon that greater representation be added to the board. In the years ahead, we must improve communications with faculty leadership and responsiveness to faculty governance safeguards. Why? Because faculty are in touch with the day-to-day academic life of the university. We know our students, our research programs, academic departments, and the staff with whom we work. Our professional commitments sustain the academic mission, and it is our common aim, rooted in our academic identities, to advance the university mission. My colleagues remain grateful for the service by each of the trustees, and we look forward to learning how both to develop and incorporate best practices in the years ahead. We hope that the trustees reach out to faculty leaders and engage with us, making sure that faculty decision makers are central to the ongoing governance of the institution of which we are so proud. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for any of these three? I don't see any. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. With that, we'll bring up Dave Reese and Helena Schlegel, please. Mr. Reese, I understand you're going to kick this panel off, please.
Chair
Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is David Reese, and I'm the General Counsel and Secretary to the Board of Trustees at Portland State. PSU, OSU, and U of O's inaugural boards were confirmed by the Senate in November 2013 and began meeting shortly thereafter, that December. Eastern, Western, Oregon Tech, and Southern's boards were confirmed a year later and also began meeting shortly thereafter. And my colleague at Eastern wanted to make sure that I made clear that their board has actually been meeting regularly since they were first confirmed, although they first took full governance responsibility in July of this year. We at Portland State are fortunate to have excellent and diverse trustees. They are huge supporters of the university. There are six alums on our board, six current or former foundation board members, business people, community and civic leaders, major philanthropists, a student, a faculty member, and a staff member. Actually, our student currently is a graduate student. We had an initial student trustee who was an undergrad, and our current student trustee is a graduate student. All of those members are full voting members of the board. That was one of the most heavily debated and discussed issues back in 2013. What should membership be? Who should vote? And ultimately, it was concluded by the committees involved that a faculty, a student, and a staff member should be the designated spots, and whether or not they have the right to vote is determined by the governor upon appointment, and the governor appointed them all as full voting members of the boards. Together, this board represents our community, understands our community, and shares a fiduciary obligation to our community. The State Board of Higher Education, on the other hand, although a dedicated and very hard-working group of people, were never this focused on our university or representative of our university and its unique needs and perspectives. With Senate Bill 270, the legislature provided the universities with a rare and exciting opportunity to set up a governance structure from scratch. At PSU, we retained experts from the Association of Governing Boards of Colleges and Universities to guide us. With their help, we adopted bylaws and a series of initial board policies. We established a committee structure with a Finance and Administration Committee, an Academic and Student Affairs Committee, and an Executive and Audit Committee. We established an independent audit function that reports directly to the board. We established policies about how the board considers and sets tuition, how they evaluate the president, and how the university incurs debt. We did all of this with best practices and the unique needs and circumstances of PSU in mind. Our board has made great effort to be transparent and accessible. Since confirmation, we have had 12 full board meetings and 31 committee meetings. At all regular board meetings, the board sets aside at least 30 minutes for comments from members of the university community, in addition to providing a standing invitation to the president of our faculty senate and to the president of the student body to address the board at the beginning of each meeting. Anybody can sign up to receive electronic notices of all board and committee meetings, and over 110 individuals have done so. All of these meetings have been on our campus. This is significantly greater attention from and accessibility to the university's governing body than had ever been the case under the state board. Again, not because the state board didn't care, but because they didn't have the ability to focus this deeply on any one institution. Not only are there more meetings, but there is more and better information. As an independent institution with its own board, we now generate our own audited annual financial statements, which are reviewed carefully by the board. Our Finance and Administration Committee meets and reviews quarterly financial statements. All of this is available to the university community and to the public, which is a level of transparency that has really never been the case before at PSU, not because we didn't want it, but because it wasn't available. This first year has been busy. In it, our board undertook for the first time those tasks which are the critical responsibility of academic governing boards. It set tuition. It approved the university funding request to the HEC. It approved the university budget. It evaluated the president. And it approved new capital projects. And the board will now do those things all annually or biannually. Setting tuition was perhaps the hardest. Initially, our board approved an increase in resident undergrad tuition for 2015-16 of approximately 4.2%. Nobody was happy about that. The board spent a lot of time on it, ultimately determined in its fiduciary capacity to look out both for current students and the future of the university that that's what it had to do. But it also made clear at that time that if the legislature provided more funding in the 2015-17 budget than had been assumed, then the board would reconvene to consider a tuition reduction. Thanks to you and your colleagues, that is what happened. The board convened a special meeting in July to reduce the undergraduate tuition increase to approximately 3%. As a result of this action of our board and of its responsiveness to what it heard from our students, PSU was the only university in Oregon to reduce tuition following the 2015 legislative session. Finally, another difficult issue that the board tackled this year was campus public safety. For years, we have had a debate on our campus about whether the university should have a dedicated and armed campus police department. Our board created a special committee to study and consider public safety generally and the need for campus police in particular. That committee held public meetings at which every member of our community who wanted to be heard was heard. Those meetings were held at various times of the day to offer maximum accessibility. We set up a web page so that every member of the community could provide comment to the board, and over 150 persons did so. Ultimately, the board approved the proposal to move forward with a campus police department, but the board heard loud and clear from those who had concerns and from those who were opposed. In response to those concerns, the board made significant changes to the proposal before approving it. This sort of process, this level of dialogue and listening, the revisions that the board ultimately made would not likely have happened had this been a decision of the state board. There are those on campus still unhappy about the board's decision, of course, but there's a significant difference between not being heard and not getting exactly what you want. Going forward, our board believes it is essential that we work with all university stakeholders so that every student in Oregon who wants to attend college can do so and can graduate. Our universities have a long way to go to improve affordability and to assure that we have the faculty and student services needed for our students to graduate on time and with less debt. That the legislature could again drastically reduce university funding is a significant concern for our boards and presidents. In the event of another recession, our students cannot withstand greater tuition increases, and PSU no longer has the financial reserves to weather the storm. I want to close by thanking you and your colleagues for placing such great trust in us and appointing great trustees to lead us forward. And I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Reese. Without asking you to represent the other institutions too much, can you share where some more sort of general comments? Your comments were very specific to PSU, and sure. Certainly glad to hear those. But what else can you share about the experiences of the other institutions?
Chair Reed, all seven of us talk quite a bit, the board secretaries and general counsels, and I think we've all taken a very consistent approach to how we've structured our boards, how we've structured our meetings, how we provide opportunities to the public to comment at those meetings. It's a work in progress. Each of us have tried different things and continue to try things in a different way. But I think we've all been very consistent in the way we've set things up and have gone about being accessible to our communities, being transparent, how we have committee structures and committee meetings. There's been a great deal of consistency, somewhat similar to what Ben Cannon said in terms of collaboration, being the case among the universities when it's not forced upon us. That's really been the case, I think, in terms of how we've set up the boards.
Okay. Thank you. Before we hear from Ms. Slagle, any questions for Mr. Reese? Okay. Please stick there if you can. Ms. Slagle.
Chair Reed and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to be able to share my experiences and thoughts on shared governance at Oregon universities. I have a few comments I want to share.
I was waiting for a moment to see if you were going to introduce yourself. If you could please do that for the record. Thank you.
I have a few comments I want to share with you based off my experiences as an undergraduate student, the current student body president at the University of Oregon, and then a current student trustee on the U of O Board of Trustees. And my name is Helena Schlegel, and I am an economics and Spanish major. First and foremost, I believe that these institutional boards serve their universities with passion because the trustees have personal ties to the universities they serve, whether they're alumni, members of the campus community, or have other involvement with the university. This personal investment in governance, I think, is important and results in board functioning with passion and vigor. Second, meetings are held on their respective campuses, making it more accessible to the different campus stakeholders than the previous Oregon State Board of Higher Education meetings. This allows students and other members of the community to be more engaged in the governing processes without missing significant class or work time to give testimony to their boards. And lastly, the institutional boards give the university the freedom to prioritize budgeting matters that are most prevalent on their respective campuses and focus on campus-specific policies. In addition, having student, staff, and faculty trustees allow the boards to be more aware of the needs of all of its campus constituents. And while there are aspects of the board that are functioning well, I do believe there are areas that can be improved to ensure our boards are as
are effective and representative of the university as possible. To ensure that the board is as accessible to all campus communities as possible, it is imperative that board meetings are held while school is in session and the majority of students, faculty, and staff are on campus. In addition, as others mentioned, holding board meetings during high activity and stress times, such as finals week, reduces the possibility of faculty and student input due to academic conflicts. When welcoming input, I hope in the future that the boards will listen more to the experiences of faculty, students, and staff regarding their roles in the shared governance models, because the outside perspective from the board is helpful and insightful. Throughout my time as a trustee, it was easy to be compartmentalized away from campus operations, and I'm a student, so it is important to encourage campus constituencies to update and report on events that arise from their respective stakeholder groups. In addition, to ensure all campus constituencies are properly represented, I think it is imperative, as a GTF at the U of O mentioned, to add an additional student seat for universities with undergraduate and graduate or law students. It would benefit both the board and the student body to have representation from their respective class of students with one undergraduate student and one graduate or law student. And from my experience being an undergraduate trustee, I did not feel that I could properly represent the needs of all graduate and law students, especially the graduate student employees. I appreciate the freedom for innovation with this new governing structure, but I want to ensure that this freedom does not come at the cost of the needs and experiences of the different stakeholders on our campus. And as student body president, I'm willing to work to continue to work with my board and state legislature to continue to improve the higher education governance in our state. Thank you for allowing me to speak, and I'm open to any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions from Ms. Schlegel? Representative Gallegos, please.
Yeah, you know, I read the newspaper article, the and your letter, and so on. Can you share with us what your experience was on the committee? Because I'm not clear.
On the board.
On the board. Yes.
Well, I think I had a difficult experience on the board, and I think it was due to some of the reasons I laid out. I felt that the students, faculty, and staff that I interacted with had a lot of struggles getting heard on the board. And yes, there's a 30-minute public comment period, but when there's only 30 minutes for all campus constituencies to have their voices heard, it's obviously not enough. I felt as a student, I wasn't treated equitably among the trustees, and some trustees treated me with respect and listened and heard, and their actions were as a result of the conversations I had. But I felt like sometimes when I shared opinions, they were tossed aside and not properly acted upon. And I understand that as a student, we don't always get what we want, but I think there are compromises to be made. And I think that when we aren't following our own procedures that we lay out when we're dealing with student matters, that it was a frustrating experience. And I was those are some of the reasons I resigned.
Thank you.
I'm just curious. I mean,
follow up?
So, yes, please follow up. It just seems similar to some of the concerns voiced by Dr. Miller, and I just wanted to try to understand some of that. Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Hayden, quick question?
Yeah, go ahead. Thank you, Chair Reed. One of my questions is for either of you or possibly for Ben Cannon. One of the underpinnings of the 2011 legislature of the 40-40-20, if you look at that 40-40-20 and you take the middle 40, seems to me that we're missing half of that, or part of that intent was to have included a skilled occupation or certificate. In the boards, is there any discussion? We heard from Ben Cannon, seemed to be a little bit, okay, we aren't there yet, maybe we want to do that in the future. But at the board level, is there discussions of incorporating? We've got, from material presented here, 198 facilities that provide those. How are the universities interacting with them at all?
Mr. Reese, I think that may be directed to you.
Representative Hayden, Chair Reed, I'm probably not the best person to answer that question because I don't know how much discussion there is at the university generally about that. Mm-hmm. But it really hasn't been a topic that the board has discussed in much detail at all.
Representative Hayden, maybe we can follow up with Mr. Cannon afterwards.
Okay.
Thank you. Any questions? Let's see. Thank you both very much for being here. I found the the exchange enlightening. I think it's helpful to have a sense of where things are going and how that balance between autonomy, economies of scale, centralization, flexibility is going. I think we'll be interested as a committee in continuing that discussion through the session and beyond, and appreciate the work of everyone here to help build those boards that are doing the work that we all depend on. Thank you very much. We'll close the informational hearing on university governance and open an informational hearing on the Oregon Talent Council. Mr. Chair Designee, Madam Director, please. Lisa Neisenfeld and David Childers are here to give us an update on the work that they've been doing since our last session. I think we have a draft talent plan. Hopefully we've had a chance to review that. And to both of you, I know there's interest in the committee, and you may well expect some questions as we go forward. So please take it away.
Good morning, Chair Reed, members of the committee. I'm Lisa Neisenfeld. I'm the director of the Oregon Employment Department. And the Employment Department is proud to be hosting the Oregon Talent Council are here to give you a little bit of information about where we are right now and where it's going. So I believe we've distributed the executive summaries of the talent plan. You'll find that the mission and vision of the talent plan is to really be the voice that connects industry to transform and inform. It's been interesting to begin to bring more voices of business to the educational arena, and then to be the catalyst. And David will talk more about our investment strategy as seed money for projects that will get us ahead significantly. This is in the face of global changes and pressures on the workforce I'm sure you're all familiar with. But as we're seeing the retirement of the baby boom, at the same time we're seeing technological needs grow exponentially every year, it seems, and global pressures on the economy are requiring very short turnaround and agile education and workforce development systems. And as our universities highlighted at our meeting last week, agility is not something you usually use in the same sentence with higher education because of so many built-in headwinds that they have. And so we're looking at how do we work together to try and find ways to allow that to occur more frequently. This talent plan really gets down to looking at what are the needs. They look not only looking at data, but went out and talked to quite a few industry folks, both in industry associations and in individual companies. And you'll see the five industries that we're dealing with initially: information technology, advanced manufacturing, healthcare, bioscience, and energy technology and utilities. We assess those needs. The strategies in each of those industries will be developed as we go, although there's an overall point of view that you'll find in the talent plan. David will talk a little bit more about. Overall, what's the difference between the Oregon Talent Council and local workforce investment boards? It's that the Oregon Talent Council concentrates on those professional and technical occupations, pretty much in science, technology, engineering, and math occupations. They are high wage and high demand, and they're often pivotal or critical to other jobs. And what I mean by that is that if you have a skilled metallurgist, you may then also allow a company to hire machinists or steel workers. But you have to have certain key jobs in order to get that organization to move further. The occupations that we're targeting then out of this are, I'm not going to read the list to you, you can look at them, but we have a category that are high demand and high growth. And some of these cross the industries, so it's not pure biotech versus information technology. One of the interesting trends was how much more we're seeing, for example, all engineers needing to know more about software. There's a muddying of these waters considerably. There's another group of occupations that are mission critical. We have to have these in order to build out our systems. I call attention especially to mental and behavioral health counselors in the healthcare industry and primary care providers. These are the glue that puts together the healthcare system, particularly in rural Oregon. We wanted to make sure the talent plan, by the way, not only addressed the Portland metropolitan area, but the entire state. Without that glue of the mental health system, we have many, many difficulties in both luring businesses and workers to rural areas. The final category are critical emerging occupations. Cybersecurity specialists are key. It gave me pause to think that medical devices now care about cybersecurity. You know, 5 years ago, who would have thought? Well, you might have thought that, but I never would have occurred to me. But also advanced materials, engineers, and scientists. We're seeing more and more of those. I'd like to emphasize these are the initial occupational clusters that the council will be looking at, and we will modify that as we go and as companies demonstrate further needs.
Can I just interrupt for a second here? You talked about the pivotal definition, and perhaps it's only me, but in looking through the executive summary, I think this distinction, these columns are really important. Could you spend just a minute more on the definition of that mission critical, and maybe sort of the distinctions between the three? Because it seems like this is informing, this, I think, what else you're going to say is going to build on this slide. Is that right?
The mission critical occupations may not have high numbers, but they're... If we want to have a healthcare system in rural Oregon, for example, we must have primary care providers, whether those are nurse practitioners, physicians, or physician assistants. They're pivotal. You need one of them in each area, perhaps. Well, maybe two. And then you have a variety of other occupations that grow up around them. But there are occupations that, in looking at these five industries, if we can't do something about these particular occupations, we're in deep trouble.
Reverend Reed, please. Members of the committee, I will just make one other comment related to mission critical. Forgive me, I'm fighting the remnants of this terrible cold.
And if you could, if you could introduce yourself too, since this is the first time you're speaking. We all know who you are, but in case those
please,
people out in
you.
Cyberspace.
Please, thank you. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Childers. I'm the chair of the Oregon Talent Council, and I live in Lake Oswego.
Thanks.
One of the areas of mission critical also in the talent plan, mission critical also takes into consideration the retirement bubble and the sustaining jobs in the state. One of the things that the talent council, as the talent plan broke these different pieces out, that mission critical piece is much the part of sustaining the most important industries that we have in the state, with jobs that, as Lisa said, may not be in incredibly high numbers in some cases, but they are critical to maintaining where we are as a state.
Thanks.
Me? Well, good. Well, let me, if I can. before I begin, I'd really like to share some of my own insights regarding the Talent Council. I'd like to first compliment the framers of the legislation that created the Talent Council. Having been an ETIC counselor, I genuinely appreciate the insight and the direction that's afforded to the council with the development of an independent Oregon talent plan. Lisa and her team, along with the contractors, worked incredibly hard and incredibly fast. If you guys have not studied this, it's a great document in terms, and in many cases, a very eye-opening document to things that we need to look at. It's a very powerful document. The council intends to evangelize this plan across the state and be a loud voice as a catalyst to try to close the talent gaps that are identified within the plan. So what have we learned? The first thing is no surprise. Employers need more qualified people to hire. Excuse me. But every industry group was also clear that they needed better trained completers. to enter the workplace. And I use the word completer purposely because the Talent Council is not just looking at four-year graduates. We are looking at community college graduates. We're looking at incumbent workers returning to education or certifications to come back and continue to expand into the workforce. So the talent plans and our discussion with the industry tell us that completers need to come with the skills, training, and interpersonal skills to assimilate and learn to be productive members of the team faster. Very simply, what industry is telling us is they need workers that come to work with the ability to learn. So, you know, very honestly, with the limited amount of funds that the Oregon Talent Council has, we're not going to address more very effectively. But what we see is an ability to partner with the HEC, the STEM Investment Board, the regional OWIBs, industry groups, and the workforce development system to carry that message of more and why more is important. So, whoops, wrong direction. So the council focused resources on better and faster. What do we mean by better than faster? Better is entering, if you look at the black line in the curve and you notice the green better, employers want workers to come into the workforce better prepared to do their jobs. But they also want the faster side, that's that learn-to-learn capability, so that they assimilate faster and they're more productive faster. Now, this is the area that we're going to spend our time on, and candidly, I think that's where you want us concentrating. The long periods of unproductive time that are reflective in that graph, which would be between the black all the way up to the productive threshold, are a financial drain on industry and the state. We think we can invest in ways to change that. Council's starting to engage industry and the universities better understand the entry skills. We also need to foster and inspire improved internships, work programs, and other experience gathering for students. Faster boils down to industry needs completers that are agile learners. We don't know the mix of attributes. Oregon industry will help us define that, and we'll know what it is to require. The Harvard Business Review defines it as willing to try new strategies, innovative, learns from mistakes, and willingness to take a risk. We see the Talent Council's early wins as learning from industry and the university system and workforce how to tighten this red curve. In closing, the council will be issuing our first tranche of investment by the end of 2015. We're working diligently with the various statewide stakeholders to understand additional needs and opportunities where we can co-invest in a second tranche by June of 2016. So we're working as quickly as we can. I am very pleased with the first 9 counselors that we have seated, and we're working quickly to fund the programs that offer a high ROI and that can be effectively scaled. Because one of our goals within the Talent Council is to bring forward the ideas that work. Our job is to seed opportunity to be able to change the paradigm. So thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
I have one quick question just to pick up on your last point, and then I'm sure there are other questions. The idea of seeding opportunities at work, it's my recollection that one of the things we talked about a lot was the notion of sort of closed-end funding. We're not imagining the OTC to become the ongoing funding source for programs, but rather to help catalyze and grow things. Is that consistent with your
number? That is very consistent. And additionally, we don't invest unless there's co-investment.
Very good.
And there are more hay points, if you will, the more industry that's involved with the program. And what I mean by seed, it's just simply the amount of money, a small kernel of investment, looking to be able to validate some of these programs that can work so that perhaps others with more money and observation can take those and multiply them as we move forward.
And the town council then can move on to the next challenge.
To the next.
Right. Thank you. Representative Gallegos.
You heard my earlier question, I think, to Mr. Cannon about sort of our non-university graduates. How are we assessing their success rates? And so I will be particularly interested in your evaluation plan at some other point in time. But, yeah, I'd love to hear what your plan is.
Yeah, Representative Chairman Reed, one of the first steps that we'll be doing this fall is that we're convening with each of the individual OWIB regions, along with the community colleges and the higher educations that are served by that region, their local government, their industries that are there, so that we can begin to truly understand where those certification levels are, where those programs can be, that we can begin to make an effective difference. That's one of the beauties of the talent plan, because the talent plan is a living document. We are constantly trying to improve that talent plan, bring more information forward, and make sure that we're working with the best information that we can.
Thank you. Madam Director.
Representative Reed, Representative Gallegos. Also, I'd call your attention to, in those top occupational clusters, they are not all four-year degrees.
Right, right.
They're apprenticeable occupations, machinists and millwrights. For whatever reason, many of those apprenticeable occupations in manufacturing have gone into disuse. And so we'll be looking to work with community colleges and employers about what's it going to take to resuscitate those. Also, rehabilitation therapists and some mental and behavioral health counselors are also at a two-year degree level. So we're looking at close involvement of the colleges, community colleges. Also, in the part of place-based learning, it's been very clear as I've gone around the state that someone from Burns does not necessarily want to relocate to Eugene to go to school or Southern Oregon. And so working with the community college to get those first 2 years place-based and maybe the second 2 years in distance learning, we're really emphasizing in the Talent Council not just the content of the training but the modality. So how do we do it better and faster in a different way? And frankly, I think the more will come with that.
One final comment from me is that one of the things that you gave in this legislation is that you gave the Talent Council a very big voice. And we intend to use that voice to be able to carry the message that we're learning from the Talent Plan back to the STEM Council. It's not our responsibility, nor do we have the funds or the time to deal with the K-12 environment to inspire to these, but we need to make sure that the STEM Investment Council understands what is actually occurring around the state. So our message and what we learn is also something very important to bring forward.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Representative Reardon.
Could you give just some examples of what proposals you might be anticipating? I know we're running short on time or overtime, but and we don't want to tip off anybody. But
what I Representative Chair Reed, the committee has been working on a set of priorities to be able to look at how our RFP process or our grant process would move forward. We've defined some guidelines associated with that. But in terms of the types of proposals that we are looking for, unlike where we've been historically, especially the second tranche of investment, let me go back in history. ETIC historically was a university-based grant environment. This legislation gives us the ability to co-invest with an OWIB or with industry or with others. So it gives us an opportunity to look at grants in different ways where we can build a pool of co-investment dollars. So the goal is to move the needle, if you will, as to how do we improve the gaps that are identified in the talent plan and that are identified in the needs assessment. But very honestly, we're in a little bit of uncharted water because this is the first time that we've really opened this up to begin to look at how this would come together.
That's okay. Helpful. Got hard work to do.
A lot of lifting over the course of the next 3 months to really engage with people and understand more about what's going on across the state.
Any other questions? Okay, we'll be eager to hear from you again in February with a further update.
Great, thank you.
Thank you very much. Close the informational hearing on the Talent Council and open an informational hearing on the Oregon Growth Board. We have our co-chairs of the Growth Board and Heather Stafford here as well. Heather may be in the other committee. Well, you two deserve extra credit for sticking around through a widely varied set of hearings. We appreciate you being here. As you get started, the declaration I need to make is that I'm an ex officio non-voting member of the Growth Board as a representative of the House. We're eager to hear from you on the work you've been doing and the potential of a continued discussion in the February session on an issue we've heard about before. Please.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. I'm Jerry Langler from OVP Venture Partners, but here today as co-chair of the Oregon Growth Board.
And good morning. I'm Patricia Moss, vice chairman of Bank of the Cascades and also co-chair of the Oregon Growth Board.
So you have a handout that either you have in your hands or will have shortly. It's there now. That's a summary of this, so I'm not going to read from it, but you can refer to it later if you like. That will give you some reference back to what Patty and I share this morning. I think a couple things. First, to reorient you, I know we've been in this front of this committee before multiple times. The Oregon Growth Board manages two pools of money, a large pool and a small pool. The large pool is called the Oregon Growth Account. It's over $100 million of assets. It gets about $20 million per biennium from lottery funds. And those funds are designed to be invested in private equity partnerships that will invest in the state and has two complementary goals. And the important thing I want to stress today is they're complementary, but right now the legislation doesn't allow them to be completely so, and that's what we want to see changed. The complementary goals are provide funds to the Education Stability Fund and to close capital gaps in the state. And it's doing okay on both of those, but we think there's a major change that could happen that could make that better. The small pool of money is called the Oregon Growth Fund. That's legislative-approved money. $1.9 million a biennium ago, $500,000 in the most recent biennium. And we're really not here to talk about that today. We can certainly answer any questions if you have any, but that's not our goal today. So we're focusing on the big pool, the Oregon Growth Account funds. The Oregon Growth Account has been in place since 1999. It is profitable since inception. It has delivered $23 million to the Education Stability Fund back. And important metrics on it, for every dollar that Oregon has invested in those funds, they have invested $1.6 in Oregon startups. So we're getting
the other partnership.
Those funds have invested $1.6 in Oregon startups. So we're getting very good leverage on our investments. And in turn, for every dollar they have invested in Oregon startups, they have seen 1.8 times value. So they're making good money on the money that they're investing in our state, which keeps them coming back. All right, so there's nothing as powerful as enlightened self-interest to make things work. So that's all the good news. The challenge we have is this. In the legislation, there is a requirement that we call the side letter for short. And the side letter says when we invest in a fund, they must contractually sign up to invest at least as much money in Oregon as we invest in them. And that kind of makes sense on its surface, right? Here's the problem. The problem is the funds that really need our money will sign that side letter because they need our money. The funds that are really strong funds that don't need our money won't sign it, even if they're going to invest in the state. Because imagine this, you are a $100 million venture capital fund. Oregon comes with a $5 million check and says, you know, sign our side letter. And they say, we've got $95 million of other limited partner investors who don't want us to sign any side letter. All they care about are financial returns. They don't care about Oregon. So even if that venture fund is dedicated to investing in Oregon, and we have reason to believe they will, they won't sign the side letter, and we can't get into their fund. And here's the impact of that. Just a couple of anecdotes. During the last legislative session, we asked to have the side letter relaxed legislature chose not to do that.
Although, as I recall, this committee was okay with that. It got stuck at a later point. Representative Wisnett was just clarifying that.
Thank you for trying.
Let's try again.
We want to try again. We'll give you a bigger club.
Yeah.
So we had a number of potential partnership investments in our funnel to invest in. One of those, a company called True Ventures out of Colorado. They're already investing in Oregon. They have a number of portfolio companies in the state. They were ready to allocate a slice of their new fund to us, even though they were oversubscribed. They had more investors than they needed, but they were going to allocate a slice to us. The side letter was not relaxed. They said, sorry, we're not going to sign that. So we are not in the True Ventures Fund. Now, we have no way of knowing what the new True Ventures Fund would do, but let me tell you about True Ventures for a minute. They have raised four funds. One of the portfolio companies in one of their earlier funds is called Fitbit. Some of you may be wearing a Fitbit on your wrist. I don't know. Fitbit just went public, and it is worth to them more than all four of the funds combined that they've raised to date. So the return on investment is staggering. Now, there's no guarantee that their latest fund will have a Fitbit in it or their next fund will have a Fitbit in it, but it's the kind of power that they would bring to the investing community and to Oregon. They are now recognized around the world as having done Fitbit, among other good investments. And so were they carrying Oregon dollars with them, we would have that impact on the Education Stability Fund returns. And as they invest in Oregon, they're going to be attracting a lot of other good investors who want to get on their train as well. So that's the one where we have quantifiable things. What's not as quantifiable, but I think almost equally as important, we had a company in our funnel called Mercado out of Salt Lake City. And I know Mercado very well because they are investors in one of our portfolio companies at OVP and one of our better ones. And so I've seen them for 4 or 5 years as investors and fellow board members. And they are a terrific group. And they serve an area that's a little bit different. They're a little farther downstream. So they tend to invest in companies that are already established but need growth capital as opposed to the very early stage. They have never invested in Oregon, but you know, having sat on the board with one of their partners for now 5 years, I had them convinced that they should really pay attention to Oregon, and there's good opportunities here. And they were willing to take an investment from the Oregon Growth Board, or growth account part of the Oregon Growth Board, and start flying into Oregon to look for opportunities. Again, they were oversubscribed. They're a very successful fund. They would not sign the side letter, and so we're not in the Mercado fund that they just closed. Those are only two examples. We have more. The challenge we have in all of this is a very fundamental one. We understand as a board why that constraint is in the legislation. It's very well intentioned. Obviously, we don't want to invest in just for financial returns with no impact on the state. Even if that would help the Education Stability Fund, it doesn't help close the capital gaps we have. But the problem is this. When we get the side letter signed, we have no higher accountability club than we have if we don't, and here's why. If someone signs a side letter and they don't invest in Oregon over the course of their fund, and so we're unhappy with them, we have essentially two options. One is to not invest in their next fund, and we've already chosen to do that with a fund that signed the side letter, did not invest in Oregon, they're up for a new fund, and we've said, go away. You know, you didn't do your part. The other option is to take legal action. And the problem is if we take legal action in one of these funds for not investing in Oregon, every other fund who we might invest with says, the last thing I want is a litigious investor. And we lose access to not only the top funds, but almost all the funds. Mm-hmm. So the accountability option we have doesn't change with or without the side letter, but our access to the top funds does change if we can have a relaxation on the side letter. Now, to be clear, we're not looking to not have the side letter ever. We will get it whenever we can get it because we think on the margin it might be a little helpful nudge. But we want to be able to have it relaxed so that we don't have to get it in order to get into the top funds. With that, Patty, I ought to let you get a few words in.
Well, and just from the remedy and the accountability standpoint is we want to have exposure from funds that are outside of Oregon and have them exposed to Oregon to make future investments. And one of the ways that we can do that is through the Oregon Growth Account. and through continual contact with those potential funds. And we aren't, Oregon Growth Board are not shy about asking those funds to meet, demanding that those funds meet to the best that they can their return requirements and their investment in Oregon. And the biggest stick that we have is if you're not performing on an investment return and you're not performing and investing in Oregon, then you are not going to get Oregon's money in the future. And that is really the strongest accountability that can be enforced.
Although I will say we do use public embarrassment as a vehicle for funds that we've invested in that are not invested in the state over a period of time. We actually do call them in front of the board to account for themselves. And so that, you know, it may not be the ultimate answer, but there's nothing quite as discouraging to someone as public shaming to get them to act properly.
So I recognize that I've spent more time on this perhaps than some of the rest of you on the committee, but that was one of the better, maybe the best explanation I've ever heard of the setup and the situation. To break it down, I don't think this is oversimplifying it. The proposal really is to move simply from shall to may as it relates to the side letter. And that's what this committee, as you recall, did in the last session. It got hung up in ways and means. But these latest examples, I think, underscore the importance of coming back to it again. So are there any questions, Representative Wisnett, please? Chair,
was the opposition, you know, worried about like Betsy or something where all the money went outside of, what was the opposition?
It's funny you used that acronym. I don't think it came up. That policy came up, but I think in general that is a fair characterization of the opposition, that people were concerned that investments would be made without having the positive and intended impact on the Oregon economy.
Okay, follow up then,
please.
But we, even if they're outside of Oregon, we're going to get benefits from that or not, from the profit, right?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. So we're still going to make money on our money.
Yeah, and I think that's the point, Representative, is that, you know, this two-part of investing in Oregon companies and return to the Education Stability Fund, we've kind of optimized so far over here that we're not optimizing for the Education Stability Fund, and we think we can do that without really losing anything on the other side.
But as someone from Central Oregon, I don't want to have Betsy upset with me either.
I think one of the points is it's adverse selection. By having this so restrictive, we're getting adverse selection for the state of Oregon.
So is that all we're going to do? Change it and put it back in? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Representative McEwen, then Representative Hayden, please.
Oh, I was just, I appreciate, and thank you, Chair Reed, I appreciate the explanation. That made it much clearer than it was actually when the bill came in the last session. So I really appreciate you clarifying it, and I'm wondering if this could be a committee bill for us. Do we have room for that in this?
What a great idea, Representative McEwen. Representative Hayden?
Chair Reed. I have a question on, you know, we tried to move from shall to may. If we move from shall to should, my question is, what percentage of funds are you aggressively trying to invest in and attract those organizations? Is that 20%? I mean, of the ones that you aren't able to ink the deal on. And if we came back and said, you have discretion over 30% of these funds and 70% are going to get the side letter. Is there something in the middle there that we might be able to do?
Representative Hayden and Chair Reed, it's a good question. I can tell you, at first, there's two ways to answer that. Is it number of funds or number of dollars in funds, right? Because it turns out that
dollars.
If it's dollars, then it's a higher number that we would want the flexibility on, because it turns out the top funds tend to be the larger funds, right? So I will tell you that at the Patty, if I get this number wrong, please correct me because I'm not positive. The sales funnel we had, if you will, for the funds we were looking at the end of June was about $40 million, and it went down to 15.
Yes.
Something like that.
That's about right.
So we lost more than half went away when the side letter didn't go away.
And those are potential investments by the state, not of the total funds. That $40 million is what the state might have been
that
able to invest.
That was Oregon Growth Account money. We wouldn't have invested all $40 million. We didn't have that much to invest. But we had the option potentially to have $40 million of places to go.
Got it.
We would have put probably about 20 of that 40. So, but we lost more than half of our targets went away when the side letter did not get relaxed. And again, please, Representative.
So follow up, just please. To make sure it's clear. I understand negotiating and working on a deal, but when it comes to signing, are you saying that you did 15 out of the 40 million, and you would have done 20 without the side letter, or are you saying you would have done all 40 without the side letter?
I think I confused that. My apologies.
Okay. Well, and neither, actually. Sorry.
Okay.
So we had 40 in the funnel. It wasn't we were going to do all 40.
Okay.
When the side letter didn't go away, that went to 15 in the funnel. We didn't do all. We're not going to do all 15 either, right? We're still being selective in the 15. But the magnitude of the drop was well over half of what we could even look at.
Okay. And perhaps Representative Hayden and Chair Reed, perhaps I can provide just a little more detail. A pool of 40, a goal of investing 20 to 25, and out of that pool, we were able to invest 5. So that gives you the magnitude of the
So if we issue. Came back with a proposal that allowed you to invest 50% of the funds without a side letter, that'd be...
It would be far better than what we have today.
And it's different based on the pool that's available to us, the economy of the time, and how we're trying to diversify the Oregon Growth Account pool. So the Mercado example that Jerry spoke of earlier, there are fewer funds in that diversification that we're trying to attract. So we could rule out, without the side letter, 100% of a whole class of funds that we'd like to attract.
Thank you.
Well said. Good questions. Thank you. Any questions down here, gentlemen? Let's see. Okay. Well, I appreciate the reminder, and I'm sorry I will not be at the meeting this afternoon. We have other committee meetings here. But I think this is very helpful. We've been joined by Heather Stafford. Do you want to add anything to the conversation? I know you were in another committee moments ago. Your choice.
I would.
Please, come on up.
Hi, Chair Reed and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Heather Stafford. I'm the Assistant Director of Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Business Oregon. And I actually just wanted to share with you an announcement that came out today for a program that the Oregon Growth Board is acting as advisor to, which is a rural entrepreneurship investment program. So this came out of, there were two investments actually. One was the Portland Inclusive Startup Fund, which was a $250,000 investment into a $3 million fund for Portland, Multnomah County specifically, entrepreneurs from underrepresented populations, women-owned businesses, minority-owned businesses, things like that. And I think the state looked at that as one strategy, which is great for the urban population, but there still was a gaping hole in the rural capacity for innovation and entrepreneurship around the state. So I just wanted to share with you this RFP that just was announced today and field any questions that you might have about it. Just sharing briefly that the Oregon Inc., Oregon Innovation Council, and the Signature Research Centers and Initiatives are one strategy for cluster building, for building specific industries and research and commercializing that research and turning those into high-paying jobs, and that's been very successful in that regard. We also manage the Regional Accelerator Innovation Network, or the RAIN Network, in the South Willamette Valley, which was an effort to build regional capacity for innovation and entrepreneurship, which we greatly recognize at Business Oregon with a Grow Our Own strategy that's very needed. But right now, that's the only existing hub where it's gotten state support. And so this is an effort to test the waters a little bit, to support some ideas, some creative capacity building efforts out and around the state, specifically those counties not within an MSA or a metropolitan statistical area, or if they are within
population
that.
Numbers.
Yeah. Representative, was it?
Population numbers?
Yeah, populations less than 30,000.
30,000. Thank you. Because originally it was less than that. Is that correct?
Well, we had Representative Reed and Representative Witzel. Yes, we did go around about that with our economist, and 30,000 was the right benchmark number according to him.
That
so that's what we used.
Same one.
No, I can't remember what you're talking about. I think that was another program. Okay. We're just trying to recall a different program that we both remember Redmond being impacted by its population size. But I'm thinking that was a different program. Am I remembering that correctly?
It's a different program, and the emphasis on this program is that it's less about the organization's location and more about the entrepreneur's location. So, for instance, a Portland firm could have a virtual accelerator that was focused entirely on building skill sets or getting angel groups or seed funds out in rural districts. And as long as it was those rural districts who were served, they would also qualify.
If I might just say one final comment that I'm a little bit over my skis, but only slightly here, but because you won't be at the meeting this afternoon, we will be voting this afternoon as a committee, the Growth Board, to make a distribution to the Education Stability Fund, which has not happened in a number of years. So expect more money.
Okay. So you're all embargoed.
That's that, right. Yes. And we assume the vote will be positive, but it hasn't happened yet.
So that's good news. And second nice announcement this morning. Thank you very much for both of those things. And we'll hope to see you back in February. Thank you. We'll close the informational meeting on the Growth Board. And good news, we've exhausted our agenda with a little bit of time to spare. Is there anything else you'd like to bring before the committee, anyone? Oh, yes. So I think there is definitely, I'm certainly interested in a committee bill to address the side letter. It seems like there's at least some other interest in that. There is, we've been talking with the HEC. They have a desire for what might be described as a cleanup bill, so still exploring what exactly that means, and I'm glad to keep it posted. And there's another idea I'd like to talk with the vice chairs about just before it goes too far yet, and that that would be our three. So I think that's where we are, but I'll definitely keep you posted. There's a little more detail to work out before we're ready.
Okay.
Anything else?
Okay. Thank you for that. There was a draft bill that I submitted on behalf of the minority to the chair, and we're going to talk about that, and if it's not acceptable, then the chair has agreed that we will at least hear the bill.
Absolutely, Representative Wisner. And I think that I'm hopeful that there's a way to get that bill introduced. So I do want to talk with you about that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else to come before the committee?
Thank you.
Okay, we're adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.